Okay, good afternoon and welcome to all. This is our monthly meeting of the Midcoast Forum in Maine, held today at the resort of Point Lookout between Camden and Belfast. My name is Mac DeFord, and I'm the head of the forum, which was founded in 1983 by a small group of retirees living in the Midcoast of Maine with an interest in foreign policy. And today, we're very pleased to have Alan Wells, who is a professor at Bowdoin. He's been at Bowdoin since 1988. Before that, he was at North Carolina for 9 years. His scholarship has focused on Mexican history. And today, his topic is So Far From God, So Close to the United States, Mexico's Most Pressing Challenges. Alan.
Thank you.
That is the best title we've had in years.
Thank you very much. I can't claim this title. The title of the talk comes from the venerable dictator of Mexico, Porfirio Diaz, who ruled the country for 35 years from 1876 to 1911. And it conveys a sense of Mexicans' great ambivalence about its powerful neighbor with which it shares a 2,000-mile border. But today I want to speak to that love-hate relationship and how it manifests itself in relations between our two countries. I'll focus today on Mexico's transition to democracy since 2000, when for the first time in 70 years, the country experienced an openly contested election. And I'll also talk about the drug war, which has consumed the country over the last few years and has cost the lives of more than 40,000 of its countrymen. What I probably won't have time to touch on is immigration, but perhaps we can speak to that issue if someone reminds me in the question and answer period. Feelings about the United States are contradictory at best in Mexico. As early as February of 2004, with Mexico and the United States competing for a North American slot in the Athens Olympic Games, a game was played in Guadalajara. This is a contentious rivalry between the United States and Mexico. Some American team members had made a few disparaging remarks about their rivals, and one had reportedly urinated on the pitch just before the game began. And a small but significant minority of the crowd in Guadalajara, of 50,000, started chanting, "Osama, Osama," in obvious reference to 9/11. What makes this even more striking is that Guadalajara is in Jalisco, the state of Jalisco, and you would think that if there's one part of Mexico that is pro-American, it's Jalisco. Why? Because since the late 19th century, Jalisco is probably the largest migration-sending state in all of Mexico, with Michoacán, Guanajuato, and Zacatecas, three other states in the center of the country. Jalisco and those three states account for 70% of all immigrants, legal and otherwise, to the United States. Of course, Mexicans have no cause at all to resent or fear the Colossus to the north. They only lost about half of their territory to the United States between 1846 and 1848, during the U.S.-Mexican War, right? And, of course, they experienced direct U.S. intervention during the Mexican Revolution between 1913 and 1914 when Woodrow Wilson occupied the port of Veracruz in his efforts to install democracy in Mexico and held on to the port until the dictator Huerta was removed from power. And, of course, the United States militarily intervened in Mexico when Black Jack Pershing followed Pancho Villa across the border after Villa had shot up the town of Columbus, New Mexico, only the second time in U.S. history that a foreign entity, I guess you could call Pancho Villa and his army, had invaded the territorial United States. 17 Americans were killed in that raid on Columbus, New Mexico, and Black Jack Pershing and 10,000 troops went across the border and spent an entire year looking through the deserts of northern Mexico trying to find Villa. They never did find him. And, of course, Mexico is still very much in the minds of Americans. And here we see an interesting image of Arizona doing the job the feds won't do with Governor Brewer there. And that, of course, has been much in the news about the tough immigration law which Arizona recently passed. Truth be told, however, many Mexicans admire Americans, but they also enjoy insulting, deceiving, and taking advantage of us. 32% of those interviewed in a recent poll expressed what the Mexicans call desprecio, or looking down upon Americans, while 34% expressed admiration of Americans, and 38%, I guess some felt both ways, resentment. These numbers vary by region. The northern part of Mexico is usually more positive about the United States, the south less so. Younger people are more positive about Americans, the elderly less so. Left-of-center people who hold left-of-center political views more negative about the United States, conservatives more positive. 46% of all Mexicans consider their country's proximity to the United States more of a problem than an advantage, while 45% think the opposite. One interesting response is that between one-third and two-fifths would immigrate to the United States if given the opportunity. So you can see these wildly contrasting, ambivalent views about the United States. In fact, in many ways, Mexico today is more North American than ever before. In 2008, 11% of all native-born Mexicans reside legally or otherwise where? In the United States. That is the highest share in history. Many possess dual nationality, about 3 million of them. A great deal more will do so in the passage of time, especially if the 6 or 7 illegal Mexicans currently in the United States are amnestied at any point in the future. Mexicans are strongly in favor of foreign investment, even as they know full well that the great majority of that investment will come from, you guys guessed it, North American investors. But 70% of all Mexicans thought that foreign investment should continue to be banned in oil exploration, production, and distribution, or gas stations. And 60% felt the same way about electric power generation, telecommunications, and the media. That, in other words, U.S. investment should be kept out of those areas. In short, Mexicans want foreign investment, even U.S. investment, but not where foreign investment wants to go in Mexico. Other puzzles. When asked if children should be taught Mexican history and the story of Mexican heroes, or should they be taught English and how to use computers, the second choice came out on top. When asked, should Mexicans become more like the United States in order to create a greater number of jobs, even if this comes at the cost of losing some of their traditions or their culture, the two came out about equal. When asked, is it more important for Mexico to maintain its sovereignty, even at the cost of the well-being of its population, or should seek to improve the well-being of its population, even if this were to make the country less sovereign, the second option won hands down. Should Mexico have good relations with Cuba or Venezuela, even if this angers the United States, or have good relations with the United States, even if this angers Cuba or Venezuela, the second option beats the first 2-1. Should the border between the two countries be open to migrants, trade, and tourism? Or should it be closed so that drugs, arms, and money, and drug money not cross? The first option won, right? So even in these, when you talk about specific issues, there's a great deal of contradiction in how Mexicans feel about the United States. More confusingly, public opinion on the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, has changed since its passage in 1994. Isn't that a great one? The middle class, in particular, is strongly in favor of NAFTA, despite the fact that it has been much less of a resounding success than its advocates had hoped and advertised. Mexican economic growth has been modest at best since NAFTA went into effect in 1994, on average less than 3% a year. As a result of NAFTA, by 2008, practically everything could be imported into Mexico from the United States and Canada duty-free, including used cars, corn, beans, powdered milk, and other products. Those were the last restricted products on the wait list since the treaty was signed. Mexico has become one of the most commercially open economies in the world, which for many of you who have studied and know about Mexico is a remarkable turnabout from even as late as the 1960s and 1970s, when Mexico had one of the most closed economies in all of Latin America. One thing that NAFTA did not change was Mexico's economic relationship with the United States. It has been, and it continues to be, an economic appendage of its northern neighbor. In 1895, 70% of all of Mexico's imports and exports were from and went to the United States. 100% of its imports and exports went to the United States during World War I and World War II, and anywhere between 65 and 70% in the 1970s and 1980s. And today, more than 80% of Mexico's imports come from the United States, and 80% of its exports go to the United States. So that relationship is firmly fixed. The next largest trade partner, is China, with a paltry 7.5%. NAFTA has not diversified Mexico's trade. No policy will ever trump geography. Mexicans are accustomed to exporting next door and have no desire to venture far away when they can enjoy the luxury of selling to the world's largest market nearby. So on the one hand, Mexicans distrust and denigrate the United States, and on the other, they possess one of the world's largest concentrations of trade with one partner, just like Cuba did with the United States before 1959, as you may recall. That no doubt breeds resentment. So too does tourism. Close to 90% of all visitors who travel to Mexico come from the United States. Mexico is 10th in the world in tourism dollars. Tourism constitutes the number one industry in terms of employment, with nearly 2.5 million jobs, either directly or indirectly. It's the number three generator of hard currency next to oil and manufacturers. Those are legal products. And it represents the only economic activity that is at least partially spread out through various parts of the country. Tourist visits declined in 2009 by 6% over the previous year. The reasons were the H1N1 virus that you may recall, the war on drugs, and the worldwide recession. I'm a little bit out of order here. Another pillar of the Mexican economy, as you know, is remittances, what Mexicans who work in the United States send back to their family members. I'm sure you've all seen structures like this, Western Union places with signs in Spanish, where a lot of that money gets sent back from the United States back home. Virtually 100% of the between $20 and $25 billion in remittances every year originates in the United States. This represents approximately 2% of Mexico's GDP, three times what it was in 1985. Mexico has today one of the highest shares in the world of native-born population residing abroad, as I said, 11% in the United States, several times what it was in the 1960s and 70s. While that is less than El Salvador, which has 16%, and Ecuador, which has 15%, but unlike those other countries, Mexico has almost all of its eggs in the United States basket. That's where almost all of its immigrants go to the United States. So all of this begs the question, if the United States is the source of many of Mexico's ills, why in the world would so many Mexicans want to go there? Back in the 1970s, when a different economic model was in place in Mexico, which emphasized domestic investment, foreign domestic investment represented less than 1% of GDP, a tiny figure. Mexico banned foreign investment from many sectors of its economy, oil, electric power, media, mining. Then, in the late 1970s, things changed. The domestic savings rate in Mexico dipped. It needed to find a way to sustain previous growth rates. Like just about every nation in the so-called third world, Mexico sought external credit, of which there was plenty during the 1970s, thanks to the billions of petrodollars circulating around the globe after the quadrupling of oil prices in 1973 during the OPEC oil crisis. Only a decade later, Mexico, like much of Latin America, plunged into a debt crisis. It was literally reduced to bankruptcy. It had virtually no economic growth at all during the 1980s, and Mexico found itself obliged to court the International Monetary Fund, other banks around the world, and to adjust its laws accordingly. In the late 1980s and early 1990s, various restrictions on foreign investment were lifted, such as the 51% ownership rule, and foreign ownership of mines and petrochemicals were allowed. After NAFTA, a noticeable increase in foreign investment did occur, from below $12 billion per year to more than $15 billion per year between 1996 and 2000, about 3.5% of GDP. So remember, I said in the 60s and 70s, there was less than 1% of foreign investment in Mexico for GDP. Now we're up to about 3.5%. But the investment could not be sustained. By 2005, Mexico's foreign investment share of GDP was back down to 2.5%, and 3 years later, the first year of the worldwide recession, it had dropped further to 1.8%. Foreign firms were disinvesting in Mexico over the last few years, or have been disinvesting. Today, Mexico is capturing a shrinking part of the world's investment pie, whereas countries like Brazil, whose economy is roughly 17% larger than Mexico, is receiving twice as many dollars, yen, and euros from abroad. And if Mexico, Mexico will find it difficult to grow if it does not attract 2 to 3 times the amount of investment from abroad that it is receiving today. So now we understand why old Porfirio Diaz was of two minds about what Mexicans call los pinches gringos, those lousy gringos. After all, despite the blurring of our two borders, we come from two very different cultures. and we respond very differently, especially when a crisis hits. For example, when the H1N1 virus, here's some slides of tourism, when the H1N1 virus broke out and swept through Mexico and the United States in the spring of 2009, nearly 100 people died in Mexico, a lot of them in the capital. And somewhere around 10,000 cases were detected around the globe, chiefly in the United States and Mexico. Now, listen to the way these two countries dealt with the crisis. This will tell you something about the cultures of our two neighbors. In Mexico, the government acted, what you might think surprisingly, very proactively. They closed all schools and universities for upwards of a week. They locked down economic activities and commerce, including restaurants, in several large cities. They canceled concerts, movies, even soccer games. Now that's something. And they virtually forced the entire population to wear ineffective face masks. What did the United States do? In the United States, everything remained open, you may recall, when the H1N1 virus hit, while everything to the south was closed. In the United States, the Obama administration suggested people wash their hands and get a flu shot. Schools in the United States remained open, while those to the south, as I mentioned, were closed. Why did this happen? Why two different responses to a crisis? The answer lies in how Mexican health authorities perceive their own countrymen. They concluded that without raising the alarms well above what the epidemic merited, Mexicans would not pay attention to their government. Skepticism is so deep-rooted among Mexicans, and because so many Mexicans self-medicate themselves, the government had no choice but to exaggerate the danger of H1N1. Otherwise, no one would have taken the matter seriously. Whether or not this overreaction saved thousands of lives, as health officials contend, is not the point, but it worked, even though the economic costs of those actions were absolutely staggering. In the months after the crisis, cruise lines eliminated Mexico as a port of call. Tourism was devastated. Hundreds of Mexicans were quarantined abroad. And the economy contracted 10% during the second quarter of 2009. Even more so than Americans, Mexicans have a deep-rooted cynicism of their government. I remember when I was doing my dissertation research in Mexico many, many moons ago, and it was during Watergate, and we were getting these reports back about the U.S. president who was in trouble and whether he was going to be stepping down at that point. And my colleagues in Mexico would ask me, so what did this president do that had gotten him into such trouble? And I proceeded to say, well, he tried to cover up, and he lied, and so on and so forth. And they said, and so? Right? La mordida, the bite. Corruption is everywhere in Mexico. Mexico has had also a long history of authoritarian rule, and its moments of democratic rule have been short and not always happy ones. The Revolutionary Party that ruled Mexico for seven decades after the Mexican Revolution from the 1920s till 2000 held presidential elections like clockwork every 6 years, but only one political party, the PRI, won. And the results of every election were cooked to ensure that result. And in fact, the opposition party, the PAN, was paid by the PRI to participate in each election. The trade-off was an authoritarian one-party state that ruled repressively whenever it was contested by dissidents, but in return for the Mexicans received political stability, and at least the middle class had a social safety net, health care, pensions, child care, but for the poor, for those who functioned in the bloated informal sector, they got little. No health insurance, no labor rights, no pensions, or access to public housing or private mortgages. That system began to change in the 1980s and 1990s. The 80s, as I said, was a lost decade, a debt crisis, a time when the middle class contracted, when there was high inflation and negative growth. All of this would presage a transition to democracy in Mexico, and of course NAFTA, and an opening up of the economy. Electoral reform took place. Legitimate opposition parties came to the fore. And the possibility of regime change for the first time was floated by the PRI. All of this culminated in a push to democratize, and in the year 2000, for the first time in 70 years, as I said, there was an openly contested election. In 2000, Vicente Fox from the opposition PAN, the Conservative Business Party, won the presidency for the first time. A PRI leader would not rule Mexico. The PRI essentially agreed to step down from power. Longtime Mexican hands like myself never thought they would live to see the day when the PRI would relinquish power peacefully and democratically. The PAN, which, as I said, had been a loyal opposition party, was to the right ideologically, akin to the Christian Democratic parties that we're familiar with in Europe. They had a liberal approach to economics, but a conservative approach to social issues. Another significant party, the Democratic Revolutionary Party, or PRD, was founded in 1989 in the aftermath of the disputed 1988 election, was more left of center. The 2006 elections were not as smooth. Felipe Calderón, the PAN candidate for the presidency in 2006, was elected with only 36% of the vote. Andrés López Obrador, his opponent from a left-wing coalition of the PRD, finished with just a half a percentage point less. This virtual tie led to a prolonged post-electoral conflict. It's comparable to what we saw with Bush versus Gore in 2000 in this country. López Obrador launched a civil resistance movement and symbolically proclaimed himself the legitimate president of Mexico, and he named a cabinet to form what he called a government in rebellion. And the deputies from his political party, the PRD, who had been voted in, refused to recognize the electoral tribunal's declaring of Calderón as the president of Mexico. López Obrador would be roundly criticized for his personalistic brand of politics and said that many Mexicans felt that he was jeopardizing the young democracy that Mexico had. What has happened since? Well, it should be familiar to us in this country. Political gridlock with three political parties, not two. Each of these political parties gets roughly 30% of the vote in the national elections, in the congressional elections. The PRD, for its part, the left-of-center party, controls Mexico City, which is, in many ways, the head of the federal district is probably the second most powerful person in the country because of the great concentration of wealth and power in Mexico City. So for the PRD to have control of Mexico City is important politically in Mexico. The PAN has won the presidency in 2000 and 2006, that conservative party that I talked about. But the PRI, that former revolutionary party, which had ruled for 7 decades, they enjoy a majority of the Congress as well as the greatest number of governorships. In a word, Mexico is undergoing political paralysis. From a strong executive with almost unlimited powers, which is what Mexico had for 70 years, now we have a weak president and an even weaker Congress. The PRI may have lost power, but they still hold the majority of the state and the municipal governments and control of unions and peasant organizations, and they have tremendous influence over the bureaucracy. PRI governors and regional power holders were and are the carriers of a dense web of agreements with such de facto powers such as the national and regional media, entrepreneurs, and even into criminal organizations like the drug cartels. The old political culture remains. Each party has a share of power, and they create and control their own patronage networks. The PRI's methods have been generalized now across the political spectrum. In areas where opposition parties have had to start from scratch, what have they done? They've simply reached out to former PRIistas who bring with them networks, resources, and clientels. The result is a recreation of the former system, electoral manipulation, and PACs with local power bosses or caciques. Since 2000, the PAN, lacking a majority in Congress, has not wanted to depend on cutting deals with either of the two opposition parties to get its federal budget passed. So instead, it cut deals with by promising state governors of the opposition parties who control their congressional delegations a huge transfer of federal funds to their unregulated and unaccountable coffers in exchange for unanimous backing for the budget. Vast sums of unearmarked, unsupervised resources spent partly on everything from expensive cars and trips to showy but needless public works programs. The result is the pluralization of the political elite, but a high degree of continuity with the authoritarian past. There is little room for civil society to play in the political sphere. Calderón, for his part, went about governing in a time-tested manner, prizing loyalty over competence, another sign that the political culture had not changed. After 2 years of political gridlock and two PAN presidencies, the likelihood in the upcoming 2012 election is that the PRI will come back to power. The PRI remains the same. The party has come out in defense of some of the worst governors in recent history, and its cadres are exactly the same as before. There's been no generational change, no clear project, no new practices. What has changed, of course, has been the expansion of the drug war in Mexico. And in the time that I have remaining, I want to spend some time talking about that. A war, as I said, that has cost more than 40,000 deaths in Mexico, and one which threatens to spill over to the United States. Even though the United States media breathlessly proclaims that Mexico is on the verge of being a failed state, the Mexican state will not fail. The Mexican government will continue to collect taxes, run schools, repair roads, pay salaries, and manage large social programs. The civilian-controlled military has already extinguished any real guerrilla threats, and the government, as I said, holds free elections. And its legitimacy in the eyes of its citizen and the world is unquestioned. So Mexico is not a failed state or in danger of being a failed state. I'd like to put that on the table first. In fact, Mexico is not even close to being the most violent country in Latin America. According to one poll in 2008, comparing levels of violence among neighbors, gangs, families, and schools among 18 countries in the region, Mexico ranked 10th. It was less violent in each of these categories than Brazil. As you know, Brazil is where the World Cup is going soon, in Rio. Drug cartels, however, operate as paramilitaries with great firepower. They use guerrilla-style tactics. They send heavily armed battalions to attack police stations and assassinate police officers, government officials, and journalists. Here's a partial list of murdered mayors in Mexico over the last few years. Cartels also have adopted innovative public relations strategies to recruit supporters and to intimidate their enemies. They display banners, what are called narcomantas, banners, hung by drug traffickers in public places, on highways. This is a great one. This one says, the federal government, which wants to tell you that there's a drug war going on, and then provides a list of government officials who have taken millions of dollars from the cartels over the last few years. And the punchline at the end of it is this question, which says, and so this is the way they fight the war on drugs, right? This is how the cartels use, shall we say, mass media to get their message across, these narcomantas. And the drug cartels send very brutal messages about what happens to people who cross them. So I'm going to show a very bloody slide right now, which is typical, which is found on YouTube, and which the cartels has a way of sending messages here. So let me show that very briefly. If you want to look away, please do so. In fact, there is a long working relationship between the drug traffickers and the PRI, dating back to World War II. True to its co-optive, paternalistic nature, the PRI established patronage networks with drug traffickers. Just as it did with other sectors of the economy and society, this arrangement limited violence against public officials and top traffickers, and made sure that judicial investigations never reached the upper ranks of the cartels and more generally defined the rules of the game. Mexico's political opening, its transition to democracy in the 1980s and 90s, disrupted these dynamics. As the PRI's political monopoly ended, so too did its control over the drug trade. Drug lords now had to negotiate not just with the PRI, but with the PAN and the PRD. And that encouraged rival traffickers to bid for new market opportunities in local areas. Changes in U.S. drug policy in the 80s and 90s also had a major impact on the cartels. As a result of the war on drugs in Colombia and the Andes, it pushed the war to Mexico, where 90% of the U.S. cocaine supply now passes through. 90% of all cocaine now goes through Mexico. It was never like that. Where did it go before? Before that, in the 70s and 80s, almost all, about 80% of the trade for Colombian cocaine, where did it go? It went to South Florida. It went to Dade County. And we know that how that was glamorized by movies like Scarface, right? And TV shows like Miami Vice. Colombian narcos like Pablo Escobar, the Ochoa brothers, and Carlos Ledner of Medellin island hopped through the Caribbean on small planes to South Florida. And by the mid-1980s, there were 22 million cocaine users in the United States, leading to a turf battle in South Florida between Colombian hitmen and Cubans. And the result was a gang warfare as these battles raged against various cocaine cowboys of the Miami Vice era. Those drug wars led to President Reagan's escalation of the drug war in Colombia, and the DEA and feds concentrated interdiction efforts in South Florida, by the late 1980s, Colombians were withdrawing out of South Florida. They turned to the Central American Isthmus to ship their drugs north. The end result was a huge blowback of trade through Mexican cartels. There were two unintended and unforeseen effects of that blowback. It ramped up the violence in Mexico, and it brought that violence much closer to the U.S. border. This is what we call the balloon effect in the drug war. If you push down on one area, like Colombia, what's going to happen when a balloon pushes down? It blows up on both sides. And so the war spread out towards Mexico. Mexico's border cities had long been a site of smuggling. Drugs was only the latest commodity during Prohibition, of course. Rum running was big business between Mexico and the U.S. border. Later, it was pharmaceuticals, homegrown opiates like mescaline and peyote, then marijuana. But by the late 1980s, the Cali Colombian cartel had set up linkages to Mexican cartels on the Pacific coast. And by 1989, a U.S. report indicated that one-third of all cocaine was coming through Mexico. 3 years later, it was up to one-half. And by the late 1990s, 75 to 85% of all cocaine was going through Mexico. The value of that trade was said to be between $20 and $30 billion a year. Mexico's leading legal commodity was oil, which earned $7.4 billion a year. Drugs, $20 to $30 billion. Oil, $7.4 billion. As Escobar was put on the defensive and the Medellin cartel came apart, the Cali cartel took over, which had strong contacts, as I said, to the Pacific cartels in Mexico. The Sinaloa cartel in particular worked with Mexican gangs in the U.S. who retailed the coke. More recently, Mexican cartels have worked to cut out the Colombian middlemen and buy coca directly from Andean producers in Peru and Bolivia. Soon they branched out into meth, and they've always been in marijuana. By the early 1990s, a cartel developed in Juarez, which worked hand in glove with members of the Mexican government. Now, I want to give you time for questions, so I'm going to take 1 or 2 minutes to wrap things up, okay? With Fox's election in 2000, the old model dependent on predominance was truly broken, and drug traffickers were taking advantage of the political opening to gain autonomy, to end their subordination to the government, and they focused instead on buying off or intimidating local authorities to ensure the safe transit of their goods. The result has been the consolidation and professionalization of the cartels. Much larger operations spread out all over Mexico with competing cartels that have been fighting each other for territory. The most famous example are the Zetas. Originally, this was a Mexican military anti-drug task force trained at the School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia. The Zetas were initially recruited by the Gulf Cartel on the southeastern part of Mexico. Since 2003, this group now acts independently, supplying hired guns and functioning as a trafficking organization itself. For many Zetas signify terror and bloodshed. Since coming into office, Calderon has mobilized the army against the cartel. The war on drugs now involves some 45,000 troops in Mexico. There have been record numbers of interdictions, arrests, and extraditions of drug leaders to the United States to try to interrupt business as usual. But as we know, the Mexican government has not won this war on drugs, and many Mexicans feel that the chances of Mexico triumphing in this war are not good. So this has been a particularly difficult period for Mexico. What we have now in certain regions of Mexico, it is localized, is a kind of Hobbesian state of nature. Contemporary narco-violence is both extreme and exemplary. Victims are tortured and killed in barbaric fashion, often to make a point. The result is a form of violence that goes beyond the old norms of the past. Calderon has responded with extensive military deployments, but it seems unlikely that there will be any more success than previous military-style solutions to the narco business. And the policy of militarization carries risks of both tainting the army while extending the violence. Drugs, guns, and money will continue to bedevil Mexican politics for the foreseeable future until the United States takes the drug war more seriously and focuses on demand. It's not a surprise why so many Mexicans will feel ambivalent at best about their neighbor to the north. Maybe old Porfirio had it right all along. Thank you.
Alan, thanks a lot. I've got a bunch of questions here. And the first one is, you say that Mexico, there's no possibility that Mexico is going to become a failed state. But your description of what's going on with the drug wars, why are you so confident about this?
Well, I think Mexico has, even though it's only been a functioning democracy for the last 11 years, Mexico has had a tremendous record of stability over the last 100 years. One of the trade-offs about an authoritarian past is that you have political stability. The other thing about the drug war is that, as I said, it's regional, it's localized, and it's often cartel-on-cartel violence, right? So that there are large swaths of Mexico totally unaffected by the drug war that's going on. On the other hand, Juarez, right, and other areas along the border are particularly hot spots in this drug war. So I think because of the long history of political stability that I talked about and the localization of the drug war and the fact that in many ways it's not only a war against the government but also a war among the cartels for territory, I feel very confident that Mexico is not a failed state or will be a failed state in the future.
Okay, this one refers to Brazil. And if, you know, Brazil is obviously one of the BRICS, one of the most successful developing countries in the world over the last 15 years. Why has Mexico failed to do what Brazil has so successfully done in the past decade or two?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. And there's probably a number of good reasons to point to. One, of course, will be the extraordinary resource base that Brazil had, the diversified resource base, which has enabled it to not just increase its the typical kind of standard agricultural staple exports that we think of when we think of Latin America. But also, Brazil has become a major industrial base, and they've been able to parlay that diversification of its economy in a way that Mexico's not. If you think about it, Mexico's relationship with the United States historically, and more recently with NAFTA, has been one where what do they do? They export raw materials, right? They bring back manufactured goods. Their industrial base has not been as strong as Brazil. Moreover, Mexico's proximity to the United States has led to that kind of subordinate relationship economically. So there is a good side to that proximity in terms of the availability of markets, but it hasn't allowed for the kind of sustainable economic growth. That's a short answer to what is a very interesting question.
Okay, here's one about immigration policy. What are your thoughts on an immigration policy, an American immigration policy, that would serve both U.S. and Mexican interests?
Wow. No easy questions from this group here. Yeah. I was preparing a little bit for this talk, and I was reading about immigration. What is remarkable to me to learn is that immigration from Mexico, both legal and illegal, has been remarkably constant over the last 100 years. Now, we have this image of, you know, Mexicans overrunning the United States here. But I think that is more a reflection of the nature, the cyclical swings in the United States economy. When times are tough, right, nativism rears its head. We've seen this over and over again throughout our history, right? When unemployment goes up, when people are out of work, that's when you get the kind of visceral reaction that we're seeing now in Alabama or we're seeing in Arizona. But in fact, over the last few years, immigration from Mexico has actually declined for the first time in over 100 years. At the same time when the reaction in the United States has been its most volatile and negative, if you can put it that way. So the whole immigration problem is a tough one to get at. Obviously, it's clear that there is a clear need for low-wage labor in the United States. Mexicans, undocumented workers, are filling that need. That's happening right here in Maine, in the blueberry harvest, right? Mm-hmm. In eggs and Turner, in the seafood factory in Portland. Mexicans are here. They're among us. They're here temporarily. They're sending money back home, but they're also beginning to stay longer and be with us more permanently. So as long as there's that demand there for those jobs, we're going to continue to see Mexicans crossing the border legally and illegally. How do we get at this? I think some of the steps that are taken are beginning to show fruit. That's why there's a decline. If you make it easier for people to regularize and legalize their situation in the United States, what's that mean? And if you make it more difficult for them to return back to Mexico, which is what's happening right now, it used to be we tried to just keep people out of Mexico. Now we're making it more difficult for people who are in Mexico to go back home. And if you make it easier for them to get their visa status approved, that means you're not going to have this movement back and forth. You're not going to have this circularity back and forth. For the first time, we've seen that happen, and that's led to the decline in numbers of people crossing the border. So that's one positive step. But obviously, this is a huge problem that I can only wave at here. Yeah.
Okay. Here are two also related questions. Can you comment on the middle class in Mexico? Where do they fit in? And the related question is, talk about the racial divide between the Blancos and the Mestizos.
Good questions. Middle class. When I first started going down to Mexico in the late 1960s and early 1970s, there was a small middle class. And you'd see it in, obviously, the capital city in Mexico City and in provincial capitals. But if you got out into the campo, if you got out into the countryside, there wasn't much of a middle class to see. There were wealthy people, and then there was the great majority of people who were quite poor. That has changed dramatically over the last 20 years. It depends on what you mean by middle class, because definitions vary. But there is a significant, by any interpretation, middle class now in Mexico. And they're the ones who drove the transition to democracy, who demanded it. And they're the ones who are unwilling to go back from NAFTA, who are the ones who believe that Mexico's future should be tied to the United States, should be an open economy, and should promote foreign investment. So that middle class is stronger than it's ever been in Mexico. And They're the ones who are going to be, in many ways, the ones who have a prominent political role in the future in Mexico. The other question is about Mexico's sort of ethnic and racial divides. As we all know from our history, Mexico is the product of what? The blending of the white and the Indian, called a mestizo, right? And that goes back to the conquest, to Cortes and Malinche, right? The woman that was given to him when he first went up the mountain to Mexico City to capture, to defeat the Aztec Empire. And that mixture of races, the mestizo, is now, they're the predominant group in Mexican society. You know, Mexicans are quite proud of that. The Mexican Revolution, in many ways, championed the mestizo as the sort of the best of the both, the blend of the best of the both. And the great muralists of Rivera and Orozco and Siqueiros, those works that we love, really made that point in a very didactic way in their murals. If you have a chance to go to Dartmouth, to the basement of the library there, and you will see one of the great works of art right in our midst, Orozco's mural that was done during the Great Depression, which really tells the history of the Americas through the eyes of a Mexican. It's beautiful, just absolutely outstanding. Every time I teach the Mexican Revolution, I take my students there. It's just fantastic. Now, what does this say about Indians in Mexico? Well, first of all, Indians at this point are a small minority. They are, not unlike our own country, some of the most impoverished people in Mexico. They live in small sections of the country. They live under the most dire conditions. And even as Mexicans celebrate that indigenous part of their heritage, they've done little to improve the conditions of Indians. So that is work still that remains to be done. And as some of you know, in 1994, there was a rebellion in Chiapas, one of the poorest states in Mexico. It was an indigenous uprising. They took for their name the Zapatistas, after the great revolutionary leader, Emiliano Zapata, played by Marlon Brando in that great film, right? In that uprising, it was really interesting. The Mexican middle class that I just spoke about, they pressured the government not to use force, to negotiate, not to repress the uprising. And they demanded it. And the psychology of this is really interesting, because many of the middle class, they're mestizos, right? And they're thinking, there's a lot of guilt about the treatment of Indians in Mexico. And they were not going to let the government use force against that indigenous uprising. And essentially what's happened, that small chunk of the country in the Lacandon Forest in Chiapas, that's autonomous. That's run by the Zapatistas, right? They've been left alone by the Mexican government because of that. So, you know, every country has its, you know, social issues, and race certainly is one that Mexico is still continuing to wrestle with.
Okay, Alan, unfortunately, we've run out of time, but we're going to do one last question. This is an opportunity for you to help the Mexican economy. Is it safe for Americans to visit or live there?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And many Americans are retiring to Mexico and have been. You may know of many who live in communities like Cuernavaca, like outside of Guadalajara. I mean, we're talking about entire colonies of Americans who've taken their Social Security checks with them. And are living reasonably well. So the whole retiree question is something that Mexico is consciously made an effort to encourage. I talked a little bit about tourism in the talk here. The areas where tourists generally go, right, those are safe areas in Mexico. You know, if you're going to Cancun, if you're going to Cozumel, if you're going to Acapulco, if you're going to Puerto Vallarta, if you're going to Cabo, you know, those, if you're going to see the ruins in Mexico City and Teotihuacan or Tenochtitlan Palenque in the southeast or Chichen Itza in Yucatan, those are areas there's not going to be any violence. So, you know, where are the tough areas that I talked about related to the drug war? Right along the border, right? And on the northeastern side where the Gulf cartel is operating, Tampico, Tamaulipas, those areas are the tough areas. But there are many parts of Mexico which are perfectly safe, safer than New York City where my daughter lives and works in the South Bronx, you know? Thank you.